and this is our second Sunday of Lent, of this Lenten season. We're doing this series that we're calling Alive. It's a journey from death to life. And in this series, we're looking specifically at stories of resurrection. And if you didn't know this, that the story of Jesus' resurrection at Easter is not the only story of resurrection in the Bible, though it is the most powerful and the most meaningful. That there are multiple stories, multiple times of people coming back to life by God, by his work in Scripture. And last week I mentioned that including Jesus' resurrection, which is a big deal, and that's what we're celebrating leading up to Easter, is that in the Bible there are over 300 references to resurrection in Scripture. That includes some of the stories that we're going through over these weeks, but also includes Jesus' resurrection, the big resurrection. And so we're looking at these stories from the Old Testament Scriptures to the New Testament Scriptures, and we're looking at what they can teach us now, what they can teach us about God, our resurrecting God and God's resurrecting power, but also what they can teach us, what God might want to do in us and to us and through us, especially in this Lenten season, this season of preparation. And so last week, we visited the first story of resurrection in the Bible overall, and that was found in the book of 1 Kings in the Old Testament. And it was the first story of resurrection involving what prophet? Those of you guys that were with us last week, what was his name? Elijah. Maybe you've heard of him before. Awesome guy. He's a prophet chosen by God. And it was kind of the first time Elijah appears on the scene. And we talked about his story and this story that he was kind of a new prophet at the time. And there was this period of preparation. These three little stories in 1 Kings 17 that culminate in a story of resurrection in someone's life. And we talked about how preparation, just like for Elijah, preparation is an important part of our lives and also of Lent. That God needs to often do things in us before he can work through us. That there are seasons of life we go through that prepare us for the next. But this story, the story that we're going to look at today, is a story of resurrection that's also a story of doors, of doors. So I'm going to ask you, this is kind of a very easy question, but what does a door do? What does a door do? Anybody just shout it out? It opens and closes, but what's the purpose of a door? Ever think about that? What's that? Well, I heard Jesus in there somewhere. I'm like, yeah, Jesus is a door. Yeah, he does say that, but we're not going to talk about that today. But so a door, if you didn't know this, it separates spaces. It separates spaces for security, for privacy, for safety, and doors are meant to walk what? Through. And you probably walked through several doors to get in here today. Those of you guys worshiping at home or online, wherever you are, you probably walked into a door to get wherever you are as well, that they're meant to walk through. And I was thinking about this. There are doors everywhere, right? And I don't think we realize how many doors we walk through in a single day. You ever think about that? Anybody ever count the number of doors you walk through in a single day? Now you're going to do it, right? Especially our kids here. But if I were to ask you to count up how many doors are in your home residence, how many doors? You know, somebody say a lot, right? You have a lot of doors. So what about these? Anyone here have a sliding door? By show of hands, you have a sliding door. Anyone have a pocket door? If you don't know what that is, you don't have one. Anyone have a front door? What about a basement door? How about a Dutch door? Anyone have Dutch doors? Garage door? Anyone have a fire-rated door? Once again, you don't have one if you have no idea what that is. You have an attic door? I hope you have this one, a bathroom door. If not, I highly suggest you invest in one for two reasons, for sound and for smell. Anyone have an automatic door? Any automatic door? I guess garage door would kind of count as that. A shower door, I hope. We have water everywhere. A closet door. Anyone have a revolving door? Maybe you're like, I don't know, my life is a revolving door. What about a squeaky door or a jammed door that you have not fixed yet? Right? It goes, you're like, I got to fix that. And you just like, don't. What about a trap door? Ooh, anyone? trap. There is a trap door here. I'm going to ask you about that. What about a secret door? See, it's not secret anymore if you do raise your hand. So, but think about that. Like doors can have great symbolism in life, don't they? That we often talk about doors as things of opportunity, doors that open to us, doors that close to us. But one thing that I've learned about opportunity, and maybe you have too, is that hope and disappointment swing on the same hinges. Hope and disappointment swing on the same hinges, meaning to open your door to hope is to open your door to disappointment. Hope and disappointment swing on the same hinges. As we look at a door of opportunity open to us, there is no way to get around disappointment if you place your hope. There is no way. That also, on the flip side though, avoiding disappointment is not a strategy for happiness. You know what it's a recipe for? Hopelessness. Just by avoiding, we want to do that, right? Avoid disappointment. I want to be disappointed again. You're avoiding disappointment, but you're also hopeless. So for anybody who's dragged two or three disappointments through the door to you with you today, I need you to know that the way to deal with disappointment is not to close the door of hope. Not to close the door of hope. Because in our story and series of resurrection, you know where that leads? It leads to death. I'm not talking about like being buried in a grave, but basically being the walking dead, living a life without hope. That participating in resurrection involves opening the door of hope. And so in the second story of resurrection in the Bible, the second story of resurrection that we have in the Bible, it's found in the book of 2 Kings. Last week we were in 1 Kings. This is the book of 2 Kings in chapter 4 in 2 Kings. And it's a story of Elisha and the Shunammite woman. It's found in that chapter. And let me just tell you, this is not Elijah. This is Elisha. You say them really quick, they sound the same. So Elijah had a disciple named Elisha. And there's a really, really cool story about how he was called and stuff. So Elijah's like, I need to go call this guy because God has called me to call somebody to follow me and to apprentice me. And he calls this guy and kind of walks with him and shows him the ropes of being a prophet, all the things that he's learned. And then there's a time that Elijah, the mentor, it's time for him to go. It's time for him to go back to God. So he goes to heaven. But before he does, he promises Elisha, he promises that he will do twice as many miracles as Elijah has done. There's a little question and answer there that happens before Elijah goes to heaven. And would you believe it or not, Elisha does. Elisha does. So Elisha goes on to continue the ministry of Elijah. And that's where we enter into 2 Kings. And so Elisha, as he's beginning his ministry, I encourage you to read that, the first three chapters of the book. It's very intriguing. There's some really weird things that happen. For all of you bald men in the house, you're not alone. Elisha's bald, apparently. And then there's these kids that make fun of him and stuff. That's kind of a freaky story there. But I'll let you dig that up on your own. But we enter into this chapter in chapter 4. And those of you guys that have read that, you know what I'm talking about. Everybody else, you need to read it. So we enter chapter 4, and basically there's this woman. There's this woman as Elisha is journeying through some different towns. He's walking through this one town, and there's this woman who is really a woman of character, independence, and she's also described as wealthy, a woman of means. And you think about it, in this day and age, this was a really, really rare thing, especially for anybody to write about. So to mention this woman of means, who is of character, who's independent, and she's in tune to what God is doing. She's in tune to what God is doing. Maybe you know people like that. People that just have a sense of like where God is moving, what God is doing. They're very sensitive. And she's one who pays attention. We know this. Because one day, Elisha comes through her town, and she sees him, and there were probably stories already about him of the things that he'd been doing, and he comes through town, and she sees him, and she invites him to join her for dinner, to come over to her house with her and her husband, and join her family for dinner. And I have to say, she must have been a pretty good cook because this becomes a routine thing. So every time that he comes through town, he visits this little house and has dinner with this husband and wife. And so then the story goes on, and she goes a step further, that one day she sits down with her husband and has a conversation and says, "Hey, you know what, hubby? Why don't we do that big thing that's been happening called Airbnb? You know, like you got a room and you have somebody stay there." And he probably was nodding his head at that time. And she says, but instead of like opening it to everybody, why don't we do it just for Elisha and do it for free? Like, let's build a little room. Apparently didn't have an extra one. She says, let's literally build a room upstairs on our roof and to have a permanent Airbnb available for Elisha to stay whenever he is in town. And we're going to furnish it too. We're going to put a bed, and we're going to put a chair, we're going to make it nice for this guy. What do you think about that? Well, apparently that goes over well because it happens. A little room is built right on their roof, just specifically for when Elisha comes through town. And so we see this little room, and we fast forward to a time after it's built that one day Elisha's coming through town, and he is tired, and he's ready for nappy time. He's ready for a nap. And so he goes in the room, and he has a servant named Gehazi, by the way, who's helping him and assisting him. And he lays down on the bed, and all of a sudden, I don't know if this happens to you, but all of a sudden he has an idea, like you're ready to go to sleep, and you're like, boom, like has an idea. And so he lays down, and he has an idea, and imagine like the servant is probably like ready for nappy time too. And 2 Kings 4, verse 13 starts out with this. He says, Elisha said to him, tell her, I have an idea, Gehazi, tell her, you have gone through all this trouble for us. Now, what can be done for you? So go to this woman. Now, what can be done for you? Ask her that. Can we speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army? And so she tells Elisha, he tells Gehazi to go and do that. And so Gehazi goes and talks to the woman, and she replies, I have a home among my own people. So Elisha's thinking, how can we bless this woman who's blessed us so much? Go, Gehazi, go ask her, you've done all this trouble for us, how can we bless you? And her response is basically the words, my family takes good care of me, I'm fine. In other words, no, my door is open to you if you want something. I'm here to help, I'm here to serve, but my door is closed if you want to do something for me. Can't receive from you. So think about it. It's a little weird, right? It's a little strange. Elisha wants to bless this woman, sends the servant out to go talk to her and say, how can we bless you? And she says, no, I'm fine. I'm good. But she doesn't want to be blessed. She doesn't want to receive. Some of us, I don't know, do you have a hard time receiving help? Receiving a blessing from somebody? Somebody's like, I want to bless you. And you're like, no, I'm fine. It's good. Go give it to the person down the street or other person. Like that's her. Like those who have said, you know, even to the extreme here, like, you know, I don't set goals in life anymore. You know, I'm fine. I don't need to head in any direction. You know, I don't want to ask for anything because I know I'm going to be disappointed if I do. I can help others. Please just don't help me. You know, and I was thinking about this. Isn't it amazing what we often already decide beforehand that we won't do? Like before something happens, like we've already made a decision. I don't know if you ever go to the dentist, and the dentist, your hygienist, like, you know, especially when your like mouth is wide open, right? And you're like, ah, you know, they're having a conversation. You're like, aha, you know, the whole time. And like reaching in, and then they're saying like, you know what? You need to what more? Floss, right? And you've already made it in your mind, you're like, tough lady, like, I'm going to do this twice a week, max. Like, I forget, I don't have time, I'm tired, whatever. Like, you already made up your mind. She's like, you need to floss more. And you're like, uh-huh. You know, like, the whole time. Like, we already make up our mind before the question comes. And I think that's what happened here, is that we're not talking about a lazy woman here. She already built a room. You know, but there's one thing in her life, and I think there's one thing maybe in yours, that she's afraid to mention. A reason why, something that she does have, but it's something that she's held back because she has been disappointed. She's disappointed. But it's something that Elisha's going to discover. Because Gehazi goes back and says, guess what? She don't want nothing, right? And so let's nappy time, right? Let's get nappy time. But then Elisha, he says this in verse 14. He asks the question, what can be done for her? What can be done for her, Elisha asks. And he's a persistent little prophet, isn't he? He's like, you know, I'm not a freeloader. I want to do something for her. What can I do? Like, I can't build her a room. I don't live here. I can't cook for her. What can I do? And that's when Gehazi breaks the silence and says, she has no son, and her husband is old. And then I think there was a part that was edited out of scripture that said something that he continued. He said, you know, she has no son, her husband is old. I mean, did you see him carrying the table up the stairs? That was really sad. And then he threw his back out when he sneezed. And I think he's had AARP for about 30 years now, to which Elisha says, enough, Gehazi. I don't think that it was in the Bible. But pay attention here. This is the turning point. That Gehazi says, she has no son, her husband is old. And then Elisha said, call her. So he called her. And she stood where? In the doorway. So I want you to think, just a few months ago, there was no room there at all. There was no room. But one day, this woman decided, she didn't know what was going to happen or where. She just knew it was the next best thing to do. She knew that she was called to make a door. She committed. And one day, she built a room. And now think about this. She is standing literally in the doorway of the room that she built. And I think for many of us, I think some of us here today are standing in a doorway today. We're standing in between two things, a voice calling you forth to hope and something else that's calling you back to retreat into disappointment. A voice calling us forward into hope and then another voice that's saying, no, step back into the world and the things you know. So let's look at this. Let's look from this perspective. In the perspective of facing disappointment, opening the door to hope again, the first thing that it requires is just like this woman, to take the risk and to build the room. Take a risk and to build the room. To open the door to hope again, to lean forward, to step forward, means taking a risk and building the room. Even when you don't know where it's going or what's going to happen, you know, many of us are waiting on God to open a door. Maybe he wants you to make your own door. You know, I think this helps many of us that are kind of dying in the wilderness of the one day when syndrome, right? Look, one day when I blank, like fill in the blank, like finances or get to a certain point in my career or have this certain acquisition or have a certain period of time. One day when, like, we die in that wilderness. But at the beginning of 2 Kings 4, there was no room at all. There was no room. There was just a woman with the heart to do something to serve God, to be obedient to God, and to not even get anything out of it. See, this woman, her first act of obedience, to love and to serve God, to serve Elisha in the process, led the way later to God's act of a miracle. See, hadn't she built the room, then nothing else that happens next would have happened. You know, I think for us, you know, oftentimes we surrender things to God, but surrender should not keep us from taking initiative on things. Surrender should give you initiative. You know, to find a way, like, oh, I want to be a blessing. Well, find a way to be a blessing. There are a lot of ways to bless people. You know, maybe you've had a card on your desk for quite a while with the name of a counselor and things just keep going on and on and on. And maybe for you, it's to build the room and to make that call that you need to do. Maybe you're saying, well, like, I want to make a difference in this life in the world. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe it's a call to step up to serve. You know, we have people right now that are in the back with serving children's ministry that are dedicated to these little small groups of people making a difference, a real difference in their lives. See, these are my guys. These are my girls. These are the people I want to invest in. To take a risk and build the room. Because you don't know what doorway is going to open up through that room. And so this is what Elisha says in response to this woman. He calls her and she stands in the doorway and he says, about this time next year, Elisha said, you'll hold a son in your arms. And what does she say? No, my Lord, she objected. please, man of God, don't mislead your servant. So, by the way, the words in the Hebrew that say this time next year, it literally means at the season of revival, meaning spring, a time of new life. But her response, think about this. She's a woman of great faith, but she's greatly afraid. Her response was no. I mean, the devil didn't say no, she did, right? The devil wasn't blocking her from receiving, she was. You know, but why? And I think we can all relate to this. Why? Because she's been there before. And we don't really know the rest of the story. Maybe there was another prophet that came along before and said, you're going to have a child next year. And she was like, oh, holy, that's awesome, wonderful. And then it didn't happen. Or maybe she had people in her life that were like, oh, you know, just in time, this is going to happen. Like, and it didn't. Time and time again, she's been here before. And she's telling Elisha, no, 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 don't be another one of them. Don't do it, Elisha. I like you, right? We built a room for you, a little Airbnb for you. Don't do it. Don't mislead your servant. I think sometimes for us, life has let us down so many times that we won't even let hope in when it comes knocking at the door. And it's because we're so scared of being disappointed. So scared. But then we're told in verse 17, the contrary to woman saying, no, 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 Elisha, just stop it right there. But we're told the woman became pregnant. And the next year, about that same time, once again, this time next year, at the time of revival, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. And you know, I looked back in the scripture, and we just read this whole section together, so there's nothing hiding here at all from you either. But I looked and looked for the point where she said, I believe you. She never did. She never did. She never, like, made the confession, like, okay, well, then, okay, then Elisha will bless her. No, but she had the faith to build a room with the door, and that was enough. That was enough. I think sometimes for us, just cracking the door, standing in the door to hope is enough for God to work with. It's just amazing how that works, but the story isn't over. The story isn't over, because you're like, well, where's the resurrection piece, Pastor Chris? Like, we didn't get to that. Well, this is coming, right? Okay, the story's not over. So we're told this, that she gives birth to a child, and the child grows. And then one day, the kid gets a really bad headache and goes and tells his dad, and his dad sends him to his mom, and the mom takes the boy, and there's like this really horrible scene. It's like every parent's nightmare, and the boy dies in her arms. It's just absolutely awful and terrible, and something that we don't even want to think about happening. But then we see this. This is kind of weird. So in verse 21, she, the woman, went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and then shut the what? Door and went out. She called her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God quickly and return. And he said, why go to him today? He asked, it's not the new moon or the Sabbath. It's all right, she said. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, lead on, don't slow down for me unless I tell you. So she went out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So let's just pause here. What on earth is she doing, right? The boy passes away in her arms. She goes up to the little room on the roof that Elisha stays in when he's there. She lays him on the bed, and then she closes the door. Like, that's really strange. What is she doing? Well, in a way, she was concealing the death. She was preventing the death process from going any further, meaning that the coroner wouldn't be called in, there'd be no funeral plans made. She didn't even tell her husband why. She's hope. She's hope. A little bit of hope here. Enough to cling on to say, I'm going to shut the door. She tells her hubby, she says, it's fine, it's all fine, right? Like dumpster fire song going on, right? It's fine, it's fine. But she does that. Because or else he would have set in motion the preparations for mourning and burial. She has that just little bit of hope. And so I think the second thing, right, is that when we're in that place of disappointment and we're looking to open the door of hope again, we got to shut the door on death. We got to shut the door on death. Shut the door on the things of death. Because those things of death pull us to places that we don't want to be in, places that just suck the hope out of us. I don't know what that is for you. Maybe shutting the door on death for you is those tapes in your head that are just on repeat, They're constantly saying, you can't, you're awful, you're ugly, that's bad, you did it again. Those things that just run and run and run. Maybe just shutting the door on those things that are causing death in your life right now. Maybe it's shutting the door on people that you know that are just negative and bad for you. Maybe it's shutting the door on you know, you have the news on 24/7 and you realize the effect it is having on you and your relationships. You know, that there are things in our life that just continually cause death and anxiety and disappointment and take us to that place where we see nothing but hopelessness ahead. And it may seem weird to others to do those things. But this woman, she knew what she was after, and that little bit of hope that she clung on to, it led her to do what she did next. She rushes probably a long distance, miles and miles, to go see Elisha. Because she knows that he's the only one here. He did this miraculous thing by giving her a child, so he's the only one that has anything that can do. And so Elisha sees her from Mount Carmel from a distance, and he's worried because she's a frantic woman. I don't know if you've ever seen like a frantic woman who is down to business, knows what she's doing, she's headed in the direction, and he's like, oh my Lord, right? He's standing there on Mount Carmel, sees her from a distance, so he's a little bit worried because he knows something happens. So he sends Gehazi, the servant, to just go out her, meet her in the field there, and to ask if everything's okay. And when she tells him, just like she told her husband, yes, everything's fine, but then she rushes past him and goes to Elisha on Mount Carmel, and she grabs his ankles, and she says, did I ask you for a son, my Lord? Didn't I tell you, don't raise my, what, hopes? Don't raise my hopes. Look, you did it. You did it again. She's still afraid to hope. But here she is. Anyway, she comes to him with hope. She's angry, but she comes with the little hope that she has. And then there's this little strange interaction we're not going to go into where Elisha, he sends his good and faithful servant Gehazi to go to the house and to go lay his staff on the boy and to see if that brings him back. But poor Gehazi, he runs the equivalent of a marathon here and he comes back and it doesn't work. So it's this little failure piece right here. And we see that Elisha and the woman, they're making their way back to the house. And then we're told, when Elisha reached the house, there was the boy lying dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Then he got on the bed and lay on the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. Seems weird, life to life. But he stretched out on him, and the boy's body grew warm. Elisha turned away, walked back and forth in the room, and then got on the bed and stretched out on him once more. And the boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Like sneezing, what's with that? Well, that's indicative of the soul, that the breath has returned to the body. And 7 is the number of God. It's the number of God. And then Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite. And he did. And when she came, he said, take your son. She came in. Once again, she fell at his feet and bowed to the ground. And she took her son and went out. See, friends, the story didn't end there, because opening the door to hope again, taking the risk and building the room, shutting the door on death, but the third thing is to open the door and to go out. To open the door and to go out. It's interesting that in this whole story, we never hear God speak. God never gives an audible, verbal cue to anything. The way that God shows up, he shows up embodied, and his work is carried out through his people. And I think the opening piece, we have to be open to resurrection. And you may seem like that's silly. Like, wouldn't everybody like want that to happen? Like, wouldn't anybody? The answer is no. Some of us are comfortable sitting where we are in our sorrow and our pain and our suffering and the place that has destroyed us and the place that has caused disappointment. And we're comfortable there because that's what we know. We're afraid to venture forward. We're afraid to build the room. We're afraid to shut the door on death. We're afraid to open the door and to go out of that tomb and to walk and to live and to grow and to serve God. We're afraid to do it all because of that thing that's happened, those things that have happened, the thing that have just sunk us down in that disappointment. And we're hopeless because we've allowed that side of the door to swing closed on us. And my friends, we're seeing here in this story the call to open the door and to go out. To go out, to step out. Are you open to resurrection? in this life and the next? Are you open to the possibility of a miracle? Are you open to life and things happening beyond what we can see? Because some of us really don't want it. Hopelessness will always be the easier thing to hold on to than hope. What's interesting, the word go out here, she took her son and went out. It's the Hebrew word yatzah. It's kind of like Yahtzee. Like anybody like to play Yahtzee, the dice game? So Hebrew yatzah. And the ancient Hebrew culture described it as a concept of going out or coming forth. And this word is used not just physically, like walking through a door, but also spiritually and metaphorically. In the book of Exodus, yatzah signifies the Israelites' departure from Egypt, entering into freedom and liberation, and the beginning of a covenant relationship with God. To open the door and to go out, I think this woman entered into something more that day when she left that room. And Hebrews in the New Testament even relates to this story and says this: women received back their dead, raised to life again. And just leave that scripture up there, because I think you can read that in two ways. Women received back their dead who were raised to life again, or the women who received their dead were raised back to life again. Because don't you think that this lady was glad that she took a risk? She built a room, she shut the door, and then she opened it and went out. This is a story not just of a resurrected boy, but also of the hope of his mother. Because hope and disappointment swing on the same hinges. Avoiding disappointment is not a strategy for happiness. It's a recipe for hopelessness. And participating in resurrection requires daring to open the door of hope again. And so today I want to ask you, maybe you are someone of little faith, of little hope right now, to know that that's enough. But I want to ask you, are you willing in your disappointment to take a risk and to have hope again?